This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek, third semester. This is session number 9, Conclusion of Aspect, Person, Number, and Voice.
I want to conclude our discussion of verbal aspect that we started in the last lesson. And the first thing I want to say about verbal aspect is that everything that we talked about aspect in the previous lesson was primarily discussing the indicative mood verbs. And the indicative mood is the normal mood, kind of the default mood. We'll talk about mood in a later lecture. But the indicative mood is the most common mood, just to make statements, to make assertions, to ask questions. And much of what we said with verbal aspect in the last lesson applied to indicative mood verbs. But everything we said about aspect also applies to all the other verb forms in other moods, like the imperative mood or subjunctive mood, or when you get into infinitives and participles. Everything we said about aspect applies to those as well, because all verbal forms communicate aspect. Now, once you get outside of the indicative mood, usually the choice of aspect is restricted to the present or the aorist. You don't have all the aspects that we looked at last class period. But everything that we learned about aspect applies to all the verb forms. So when we talk about infinitives, when we discuss participles, when we talk about imperatives, what we said about aspect, you'll need to remember that and recall that, because it applies to all verb forms. The other thing to say by way of summary with verbal aspect is that you'll notice a difference if you look at other grammars, especially second year or intermediate type grammars, between the way they treat Greek verb tenses or aspect, depending on what theory or method they're following. And the way we treated verbal aspect is, I didn't use a number of labels that you'll find in grammars. For example, when grammars treat the present tense, they might use things like progressive present, or they might use ingressive imperfect, the idea of entrance into the action, or progressive imperfect, or the constative aorist, or ingressive aorist, or culminative aorist. Don't worry about what all those mean. I'm just giving you examples of the kinds of labels that you find in other grammars. And I'm not against labeling things when they're helpful and they describe what's going on, but I've avoided those labels, and for a reason. Is I'm not convinced that's a helpful way to analyze verb tenses. That those meanings, like ingressive or entrance into the action or finishing the action, culminative or progressive, ongoing or repetitive, that information comes from the context, not from the verb tense itself. And sometimes the context doesn't indicate that kind of information. And I remember the first time, armed with those labels, when I first learned Greek, trying to interpret New Testament text by applying those categories to the verb tenses or aspects that I found, and having difficulty a lot of time, because I found myself mainly just intuitively putting those labels on the aorist or the presence or the imperfects or perfect tenses that I was finding, and then wondering, why did I do that? What justification for using some of these labels? And at the end of the day, I soon decided that that's probably not how the language is working. That's not how verb tenses are working. Those sorts of categories, if they're valid at all, are present in the surrounding context and are not to be read into the tense forms or the aspects themselves. Instead, the aspects simply communicate their meaning. Whatever the nature of the action, whether it's ingressive entry into the action or culminative, finishing the action, or durative or progressive action, or repeated action. That information can only come from the context and is not the meaning of the verb tenses or the aspects themselves. So I tend to avoid those labels, but you will find them if you use other grammars, such as Wallace's grammar or a number of others, will often use those labels. But I will avoid them, and even throughout the rest of this this course. What I want to do now is just give an example then of how aspect works. So how should we treat verbal aspect? If we're not to just go through and put these labels on them, how should we treat them when it comes to preparing for sermons, when it comes to preparing for Bible studies, or just studying in depth a passage or writing a paper in one passage in the New Testament? How should we consider or look at Greek verb tenses? I want to give you a really quick example from Romans chapter 5, and we'll just look at the first five verses or so of Romans 5. And it begins by saying, "Therefore, having been justified by faith," which kind of summarizes Paul's argument, at least going back to chapter 1 and into chapter 3 and 4, where he has now argued for the necessity of and has even unpacked to some extent the meaning of justification by faith. Now he summarizes his argument, says, "Therefore, having been justified by faith," but what I want you to pay attention to is the verb tenses that are used throughout these first few verses. Actually, we could look at the whole section of chapter 5, 1 through 11. I'm not going to do that right now. I just want to give you an example. But you'll notice, and here's where it's important to do two things. Number one is look at a larger stretch of text. Instead of focusing on the individual verbs and then trying to put labels on them, you know, what kind of aorist is this, what kind of present, look at the whole passage. And then look at it in its context and see if you notice any patterns. For example, if you look at chapter 4 leading up to this, you'll notice that the dominant verb tense is the aorist. And then if you look at chapter 5, 12 and following to the end of the chapter, you'll note again that the aorist tense predominates. But when you look at chapter 5, 1 through 11, and especially the first few verses, you'll notice a significant change. The very first, and I'm going to focus on the main verbs, not so much participles and things like that, but you'll notice the first verb that you come across, so this is Romans 5, 1 through 11, the first verb that you come across is an indicative of a present tense indicative verb. Some manuscripts actually have a subjunctive, which I actually prefer and think is the correct reading, but that's not the point. Now, the point is you have a present tense verb. You can't help but notice the change from the aorist tense that dominates much of chapter 4, and now all of a sudden you have a present tense. Having been justified by faith, we have, or let us have, peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have access. Notice the next verb through whom we have the access. The next verb is a perfect tense verb from the same verb as this one, echo, but now a perfect tense. We have access in faith unto this grace in which we stand. And I realize now we're dealing with kind of supporting or modifying clauses, but even now we have another perfect tense verb. Este common, through which we stand. And then, and we boast. Now we have kalkomatha. We have that two times. We boast in the hope of the glory of God. And not only this, but also we boast in tribulation. And I'll stop right there for the time being, but notice in contrast to chapter 4, and then in contrast to 5:12 through the end of the chapter, where Paul begins a comparison between Adam and Christ, notice the shift in tenses to present tenses and perfect tense forms. And so that should cause you to sit up and ask the question, well, what's going on here? Why do we see that? According to an older method, you might look, well, what kind of present tense is that? Is that progressive? Is it this? What kind of perfect tense is this? Is it consumative perfect or whatever? What kind of present tense is this? But instead, looking at the text together and wondering, why do you find this concentration of present and perfect tense verbs in the context of all these aorists? The other interesting thing related to our next topic, there's also a shift between third person, and now notice that first person plural dominates. So this should sit up and cause you to sit up and take notice and ask, what's this saying about this section? Well, it seems to be sort of a peak in the discourse. It's interesting when you read commentaries, they are disagreed as sometimes as to, where does this go in the outline and things like this. But however we treat it, it seems to be a peak in the discourse where the author is drawing attention to and emphasizing the implications of his argument for justification by faith. And so this section sticks out in Paul's argument so far. So that's one way to treat, and I think a very helpful way, often to treat verbal aspect. And I've chosen a passage where this works. I'm not saying all passages are do this or that it's always easy. Not that this one's easy, but this is a good example of where you'll get, again, when you look not only at 5:1 through 11, but the broader context. Getting away from that pin the label on the grammatical construction, just going through and labeling things with labels that you find in grammars, is stepping back and looking at the whole discourse and looking for patterns and things like this and asking, well, what's going on? Why is that there? I find that a far more fruitful and helpful approach when it comes to preaching and teaching and exegesis and studying the Greek New Testament. So we'll say more about verbal aspect and give other examples like this, especially when you get to the end of this course and look at the discourse analysis and discourse considerations in interpreting the New Testament. But what I want to do is move on and talk about three other features of the Greek verb, and two of them we'll mention rather quickly, not because they're not important, but the third one we'll spend a little bit more time on, and that is we'll look at person, number, and then voice. And for person, and we'll both of these we'll look at, go back to the Romans 5 example. For person, Greek simply has, much like English has three persons, that is first, second, and third person. And these are also indicated by the endings of the verb. So how do you know if a verb how do you know if it's first person, second person, third person? You look at the ending of the verb, just like virtually everything is indicated by looking at endings. That's how Greek works. It's called an infusional or inflectional language, inflectional language. The first person and second person tend to be the most important, because this is where the author and the readers are, especially when you have first person plural. When you find that, for example, in Romans 5, notice all those examples are first person plural. We have, or let us have peace with God, the grace in which we stand and we boast. That's all first person plural, where the author involves himself and his readers. That tends to be highly significant as far as in a discourse, things that are more prominent get more emphasis. Then second person is where the author is addressing his readers directly. And usually first and second person, you'll see that popping up here and there, especially in letters. Because Paul, for example, in Paul's letter to the Romans, or any of Paul's letters, or Peter, or John, or James, the author is addressing his readers. And so you'll find the first and second person indicating the direct interaction of the author with his readers. Whereas the third person tends to be not as prominent, where the author is speaking to his readers about somebody or something else. So person can be important. Don't overlook it. Obviously, outside of speech, narrative, like the Gospels, will all be third person. Outside of speech, where in speech someone can be addressing someone else, but narrative will be entirely in third person. Whereas letters usually will begin with I, Paul, an apostle, and some even during some places in the letter, you might have Paul saying, I, Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ. Or in Romans 5, let us, where Paul now links himself with his readers, and that tends to be important. That is person. The number I don't want to say a whole lot about, but simply singular and plural. I think Greek used to have a dual, but by New Testament times, there's just a singular and a plural, much like English. What I want to focus most of our attention on then is voice as an important feature of the Greek verb system. And Greek has three voices, unlike English, and again, I'll use English as kind of my example by way of comparison. When we talk about voice, we're talking about the relationship or the connection between these two elements in a sentence or clause, the subject and the verb. And I'll come back to that. English has two voices, basically an active voice and a passive voice. And the common explanation is the active voice is where the subject is the agent or is the one producing the action. So again, if I use the silly phrase, the boy hit the ball, the boy is your subject and the verb is hit. The boy is performing the action of hitting. Therefore, we say that's active voice. Just describing it in rather simple terms. A passive voice would be if I said the boy was hit by the ball. Now the boy is still the subject, but the boy is not doing the hitting. The boy is on the receiving end of the hitting. The boy was hit. And that's kind of how we express it in English with the verb was or is being hit or something like that. But the boy was hit. And then now the agent, the thing doing the hitting, is by the ball. But that's a passive, called a passive voice construction. So again, the boy hit the ball, the boy is doing the hitting, and the ball is receiving it. But if I flip that around and say, the boy was hit by the boy is still the subject. In Greek, it'd be in the nominative case, but now the boy is on the receiving end of the action. He's not doing the hitting, he is being hit by the ball. Greek also has an active voice and it has a passive voice that in many ways functions similarly to English. And how does Greek indicate active and passive voice? That you guessed it, by the endings. So in first year Greek, you learn active voice endings for all the tenses and moods, and you learn passive voice endings. But Greek also has a third voice that we don't have in English, called a middle voice. And that does not mean that we can't express the same thing or at least something similar in English. It just means we have to do it in different ways. We can't do it in the same way as they did in Greek. Greek has a middle voice that it shows by its ending. So you also learned middle voice endings. So for example, in first year Greek, for active voice in the present tense, just the simple present tense that you started out with, you learned o, ace, a, amen, eta, usi. Those are your active voice endings. The subject is producing the action. The boy hit the ball. The prophet spoke the words. But you also learn passive voice endings. O my, a, etai, amatha, estha, antai. But then you also learn middle voice. In the case of the indicative verbs, the middle and passive are the same. So you have to look at the context to determine, is this middle or passive? But the middle voice endings were also omai, a, etai, amatha, estha, antai, if you remember those. Once you get into the aorist and future, they do distinguish between middle and passive with the ending. So you learned a separate set of endings for the aorist and the middle when it came to the aorist and the future when it came to middle voice and passive, there were separate endings. But with the present, the indicative, the present indicative, same set of endings. Kind of the endings do double duty for both middle and passive. But Greek has a middle voice. Now, let's talk a little bit about how we understand voice in Greek. And again, I think the starting point is the subject and the verb. So we're going to talk about when we understand voice, we need to understand it in relationship to what is going on in the subject-verb complex. And remember, Greek doesn't always have to indicate a subject. It can be in the ending. If it's there, it's going to be in the nominative case. But unlike English, where we usually have to have a subject to make the sentence make sense, Greek doesn't always have to have one. It can be included in the ending. But I put it up here just for illustration purposes. But when we understand voice, we need to understand it in relationship to the subject-verb complex. Now, how I understand voice, what I think is a helpful way of understanding voice is to understand it in terms of causality. And what I mean by that is this. Where does the cause of the action come from? When we're thinking about the action of the verb in relationship to the subject and verb, where does the action come from? If the action comes from the subject, it is active voice, or what I call direct cause. The subject is the agent. The cause comes from the subject, so that's why we say direct cause. The action of the verb, the cause of it, where's the energy of that causes the verb, that brings about the action of the verb? Well, it's the subject. The subject is acting as the agent. And again, that's called direct cause. Now, the active voice can be seen. Remember we talked about the aorist tense being the default tense. The active voice can be seen as the default voice. It's just the common voice that the author is going to use to demonstrate that the subject is producing the action. So that's the active voice, direct cause. And I also need to get rid of this circle. Now, what if the action is not produced in here, but outside of it? So if you look at this as the subject-verb complex, what if the cause of the action comes outside of that? Not from the subject inside, but outside of it. So for example, what if the agent or cause comes from outside? Then you have a passive voice, a passive voice construction, or we could call that external cause, because it, the cause is external to the subject and the verb. So go back to the example, the boy was hit by the ball. The boy and hit, those are, that's your verb, your subject and verb. But the action, the boy's not doing the action. It's something outside of the subject and verb, the ball. And in English, we express that by a prepositional phrase. The boy was hit by the ball. So does everyone see that? When you see boy and was hit is your verb, your subject and verb, the action, the cause of the action, which is the ball, the thing that's doing the hitting, is outside of it. The ball was hit by the boy. So passive voice then is indicates external cause. So active voice is direct cause. The subject is directly involved in bringing about the action. Whereas external cause, the subject is no longer involved in producing or bringing about the action, but is being acted upon. The agent or cause of the action is outside. That's passive voice. Now, middle voice. This one sometimes is a little more tricky to understand, but one way to look at, again, if I can express it in English, if I say, she shut the door. So, again, this is on what kind of voice? Right, active voice construction. She is the subject, shut is your verb, and notice the subject is producing the action of shutting. So that's a direct cause, active voice. I could also say this. It might sound a little English, or a little awkward in English, but we could say the door was shut by her. Now notice the subject is door, and was shut is your verb, but notice the subject is not doing the action. The subject is the recipient. And the agent, by her, is external. It's outside of the subject and the verb. Therefore, this is passive voice. Now what if I said this? The door shut. Now we know that the girl's the one that shut it, but now I just said the door shut. What's going on? Well, now the action, the cause of the action, I'm not sure exactly how to illustrate it, is internal. It arises from the subject and the verb together. So if I say the door shut, yes, I know in reality that there's a girl shutting it, but in this kind of construction, I'm simply focusing on the door shutting. That is, I'm focusing on the internal cause. So middle voice, would be internal cause. The cause of the action comes from inside the subject and the verb complex. It arises within subject and verb. Scholars recently working on the middle voice would say the emphasis on the middle voice is subject affectedness. There's an emphasis on the subject's involvement and participation in the action. And I think that fits with the idea of internal cause. The action arises within the subject-verb complex. And it doesn't tell you, the middle voice doesn't tell you, well, is there another agent producing it? Now, when I say the door shut, I know that there's a girl shutting it, but the middle voice isn't focusing on that. The middle voice is simply focusing on the subject's involvement in the action or the internal cause of the action. So that's one way, I think, to think about the middle voice, that is, internal cause, as opposed to the active voice, where the subject is directly causing the action, hence active voice, direct cause, or the passive voice, where the cause comes external. When you think about the subject and verb together, the boy was hit. That's the subject and verb, but the cause is external, by the ball. And then seeing the middle voice is internal cause. Somehow the action arises within and from the subject and verb together, the door shut, without any indication or interest in whether there was an external cause or not. So that's one way to look at the middle voice. When we think about the voices together, again, I think that we need to think of them in kind of rank order, like we have some of the other constructions. That is, the active voice, if I can get rid of that for a moment, the active voice would sort of be your default voice. And so you're probably not going to make many decisions on active voice constructions, or a lot of them, as far as exegesis, because that's just the normal standard voice. And statistically, that stands up. When you look at the Greek New Testament, statistically, even when you consider not only indicative verbs, but subjunctives and imperatives and participles and infinitives, they all have voice, they're all verbs. When you look at them all together, the active voice is by far the heaviest used. It has by far the greatest number of occurrences in the Greek New Testament. And then the passive voice would be next in importance. When the author deviates from the active and uses the passive, then you need to sit up and ask, well, why did he do that? Usually when the passive voice is used, the author wants to draw more attention and keep focus on the subject. Again, you know, if I use that sentence, the boy was hit by the ball, I could say the ball hit the boy. That's fine. But by saying the boy was hit by the ball, I've retained focus on the boy. So that's in Greek, too. That's one of the functions of the passive voice. A good example of that is in Matthew chapter 5 and the Beatitudes. This begins the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, and it begins with the Beatitudes. Blessed is the one, that we usually translate it that way. So just looking at the first one, blessed are the poor in spirit. That's not the one I want to look at. I'll look at 4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Notice the second part. The second part is they, and I'll write this, the reference, Matthew 5 and 4. They, and then a rather long word, para, clay, thason tai. And I ran out of room, but notice that theta eta, that's your passive ending. This is a future passive. But notice, blessed are the poor, for they will be comforted. And who's doing the comforting? Well, it's probably God himself. Why didn't the author just say, blessed are the poor, for God will comfort them? Because he wants to retain focus on the subject, which is those who mourn. And so he uses the passive voice construction. Linguists often call this subject continuity. You're keeping the focus on the subject from the previous clause. Blessed are those who mourn are blessed, for they will be comforted. So the author does not want to focus on the one who's doing the comforting, although that's important. He wants to focus on those who are comforted. So again, he could have said, blessed are the poor, or blessed are those who mourn, for God will comfort them. That would be entirely appropriate. But by using the passive construction, he's able to keep his attention on the subject, those who are mourning. So that's one of the important functions of a passive voice verb. And then the middle voice would be the most prominent when the author uses the middle voice, because statistically, the use of the middle voice in the Greek New Testament is even less than the passive. And so statistically, we should expect to find the active, but when we find the middle voice, it should cause us to sit up and take notice. There's one exception to that, as there always is. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But the middle voice then would be used probably to draw attention to highlight or to make more prominent something in the context. And again, I want to give you an example. In 1 Corinthians 13, a passage that we looked at in relationship to adjectives, and when we talked about comparatives and superlatives and things like that, we discussed the very last verse that had to do with faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. I want to return to that passage, but look at something else. And the reason for chapter 13 in 1 Corinthians, this kind of Paul's kind of discourse or praise of the virtue of love, Paul's discussing love within the context of spiritual gifts, and his warning to the Corinthians is that they are actually misusing the gifts and that they need to use them within the context of love. And so notice what Paul says in verse 13. He says, where there are prophecies, and again, I'm going to write this, erase that and write this out. This is 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 8. So notice what he does. He says, where there are prophecies, which is one of the gifts that he's talked about, prophecies, he says, they will be done away with. They will come to an end. They will be brought to an end. And the author uses I'm going to run out of room again here. The author uses a passive verb form, katargei. Phasetai. Again, I won't write the whole thing out. I just want you to see, again, the passive ending, theta, eta. This is a future passive form, just like we saw with the Matthew 5 passage, a future passive. So, again, the authors use the passive because he wants to emphasize. He could have said, for example, I don't know what the agent is, but God will do away with prophecy. He could have said that, if that's his intention. Whoever the agent is will do away with prophecy. But by using the passive, he keeps the emphasis on the subject, the thing that is going to be done away with, not what's going the agent. He's not focusing on what is going to bring prophecy to an end. So whether prophecies, they will be done away with. And then the next one is glossae, whether tongues, pausantai, they will cease. And then he returns to knowledge, gnosis, whether knowledge, and then he uses the same verb form, katergeisthesetai. Again, I won't write out the whole ending. There's your passive theta eta ending. But what you should notice is the first and the last one are in passive, but notice tongues is in the middle. And why did the author do that? One possibility is when you'll notice that this verb, pausantai, frequently occurs in the middle. So it's possible the author really didn't have a choice. If he's going to use that verb, you know, that naturally you're going to put it in the middle voice. And so maybe we shouldn't make that big of a deal out of it. The other possibility is the middle voice, which indicates internal causality, the focus is simply on tongue ceasing and not who brings it to an end or specifically how it comes to an end. But perhaps by using the middle voice, it further draws attention to tongues because that's the main issue the author's dealing with, the abuse of tongues, particularly by the Corinthian church. And the middle voice may be used here to draw attention to it, to keep it in the foreground. What we don't want to do is draw all kinds of theological conclusions. Some have said, well, tongues will cease by themselves or something. There's something about tongues that they will simply die off by themselves. That doesn't appear to be the author's emphasis. He's chosen a construction that doesn't tell us about the specific cause, whether it is direct cause, is it God that will bring it to an end, how will they come to an end. But by using the middle, the author is drawing attention to tongues because that's the main topic that he's been considering, the main problem, when you go back to chapter 12, is the abuse of tongues by the Corinthian church. So the point is just be aware of the voices and again, the active voice being kind of the standard default voice. But then the passive voice, and then even more so, the middle voice, adding more prominence, especially focus on the subject when you see them. Now, I said there's one exception, and I'll just talk about this very briefly. Is perhaps in first year Greek, you learned about a category, deponent. And you learn that there are several verbs that belong to this category. The most famous one is erkomai. And there's others. Another one would be ginomai. And the point is, you learn them as opposed to verbs like luo and echo that have active voice endings. You learn these with middle endings. Erkomai. There is no erko, and there's no gino, at least in biblical Greek. You learn them, erkomai and ginomai. Notice they have middle endings. Erkomai, ginomai. And if you go to a lexicon or dictionary or the back of your grammar and look them up, they look like erkomai and ginomai. They have the middle ending. And the typical explanation is deponency. And usually I hear it something like this. These are verbs with middle forms, but they're active in meaning, actually. So you'll find they have middle forms, but they're really just active. They're not middle. They're active in meaning, and so you need to treat them like that. Instead, without going into a lot of the theory behind this, the first thing I think to realize, this was actually a Latin category, deponency, that was used to explain these sorts of verbs that you find. There's not a ton of them, but there are a number of them. Verbs that only occur in the middle voice. They don't have active endings. And so we've used deponency, a Latin category, to describe this. And we've said these are verbs that have middle endings, erkomai. You don't find erko, you don't find gino, like you do luo or echo or blepo or something like that. You only find the middle endings, omai. And so we often describe them as they're middle in form, but they are active in meaning. We treat them like actives and we translate them that way. The other thing that I'm convinced is often the case is I think a lot of people gravitate towards this middle form but active in meaning because that's what they sound like when you translate them into English. They sound active in English. But just because they sound active in English doesn't mean they didn't have true middle meaning in Greek. And a lot of recent research, I think, has demonstrated that we should probably... Let me get an appropriate pen. We should probably get rid of that category, deponency, and instead call verbs like this just middle-only verbs. That is, verbs that only occur in the middle voice. That is, there's something in the meaning of those verbs that lend themselves to just being middle. That is, the idea of internal causality, subject emphasis and effectiveness, that is true with erkomai and ginomai and all these other verbs that we've been learned that are deponent. They still have true middle meaning. Whether we can detect it in English or not, whether we can bring it out in our English translation or not, these still are middles and need to be treated that way. Now, in light of what we said about the middle is the most prominent form, that isn't the case here. Why? The author didn't have a choice. If the author wants to use erkomai, he has to use middle. He doesn't have a choice. If the author wants to use ginomai, he has to use the middle. He doesn't have a choice. One important linguistic principle is that choice implies meaning. That is, only when the author has a choice can we draw attention to it. If the author doesn't have a choice, you know, we can't draw too much attention to or draw too much meaning out of that. So these verbs I'm suggesting are not deponents. They're true middles or middle-only verbs. That is, there's something in the meaning of the verb that lent itself to having middle endings. And the verb itself seemed to communicate a middle meaning and attracted middle endings. But so we should treat them as true middles. They have middle meaning. But we shouldn't draw attention to them as being more prominent or emphatic or anything like that because the author simply didn't have a choice.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek, third semester. This is session number 9, Conclusion of Aspect, Person, Number, and Voice.